les podcasts
de Blast.
Comment raconter la vie quotidienne des Palestiniens et des Palestiniennes en territoire occupé? C'est en tentant de répondre à cette question que Nathan Scholl, journaliste, écrivain, a écrit Une journée dans la vie d'Abed Salama, publié chez Gallimard, un livre qui a remporté le prix Pulitzer 2024 dans la catégorie essai. À travers la mort du fils d'Abed Salama, tué dans un accident de la route lors d'une sortie scolaire, Nathan Scholl nous conte une vie régie par la colonisation. De la naissance d'Abed Salama dans une famille bourgeoise palestinienne, à son entrée dans la résistance, jusqu'à la perte tragique de son enfant. La vie d'Abed Salama, c'est un témoignage de ce que subissent quotidiennement les Palestiniens. Une vie où Israël régit chaque pan de leur quotidien. Une vie sous occupation, sous apartheid. Une vie qui ne tient chaque jour qu'à un fil. Une vie de colonisé. Bonjour Nathan Scholl.
Pleasure to be with you.
Alors, à partir du récit d'Abed Salama, en fait, c'est toute l'histoire de la Palestine que vous racontez sous occupation israélienne, de 1948 à aujourd'hui. Comment vous avez rencontré Abed?
So, before I met Abed, I had the idea to tell a story, a narrative, that would tell the whole story of Israel-Palestine. And because the people in Israel-Palestine live such segregated lives, you have Jewish-only communities, right next to a Palestinian-only community. Sometimes the Jewish-only community is built on the land of the Palestinian community next door, and there is zero interaction between them. So in order to tell a narrative that would tell the whole story of Israel-Palestine, I had the ambition to find something, some sort of event that would bring these people together. And I found that in a bus accident involving a group of Palestinian school children. And once I had decided on this particular accident to tell the story, I started to try to find every person I could who was in any way connected to it. And it happened to be the case that a very good family friend told me, I have a distant relative who is the father of one of the children on this bus, and I can put you in touch with a less distant relative who can put you in touch with Abed. And a few days later, I was in Abed's home, and he began to tell me his story. And over the next few years, we spent more time together than really anyone else outside of our immediate family. And through Abed's story, his family story, his life story, I felt that I could tell the whole story of the occupation.
Alors, comment vous avez effectué votre travail? Vous dites que tout part du témoignage d'Abed Salama, mais comment savoir ce qui est vrai et ce qui est faux?
The way that I reported this story was really finding every single person who was connected, who was willing to speak with me. And although the title is A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, it's a bit misleading because it's not just a day in Abed's life, but rather Abed's entire life in a day. And it's also the story of many other characters, other Palestinian parents, Palestinian teachers, Palestinian doctors, the founder of the Israeli settlement next to where the accident took place, the architect of the separation barrier, the 26-foot tall wall that runs around the community where these people live, that encircles them, known as the apartheid wall. And so I was really trying to approach every single person. Abed was just one of them, but it began with him. It began with his story, and he helped me to be in touch with many of the other parents. In terms of separating fact from fiction, this is a book that reads like a novel, but it is 100% nonfiction. There is nothing invented in this book. Every single thing in this book is factual.
Alors, pour les personnes qui vont voir cette interview et qui vont avoir envie de lire ce livre, qu'est-ce que vous pourriez leur dire, qu'est-ce que ça raconte plus globalement, en fait, l'histoire d'Abed Salama?
The book, as you know, tells the story of a tragic bus accident involving a group of Palestinian kindergartners. They come from a community that is encircled by walls, and they are forced, because this community is entirely neglected, They are living without sidewalks, without playgrounds. They are sitting just underneath the most prestigious university in Israel, the Hebrew University of Jerusalem at Mount Scopus. From the manicured grounds of this school, you look down and you see the checkpoint. You see that there's just a single road for 130,000 people in this walled ghetto. And the children on this bus had to go a very long distance, even though there were play areas just on the other side of the wall that they could not access. They went a very long distance to try to reach a play area. And after crossing through a checkpoint, they were struck by a giant semi-trailer. The bus flipped over, it caught fire, and it was more than 30 minutes before the first Israeli fire truck arrived at the scene. And who was left to try to rescue these children were ordinary people, Palestinians, on this road who put the children in the back seats of their cars. And because those Palestinians had different color IDs, different ability to move around because of the color of their ID, they went in different directions. Some went into the better hospitals in Jerusalem, some went to hospitals in the West Bank. And some of the parents, like Abed himself, could not go and look for their children at these hospitals. So that's the narrative of the book. But through Abed's quest to find out where his son is and what happened to his son, we understand the whole system of Israeli control over Palestinian lives. We learn about the checkpoint system, about the permit system, about the segregated roads, about the wall. And the real idea of the book was to offer a way for people to understand this very complex bureaucratic system in a simple way, which is to be in the shoes of a single father looking to find his son on the worst day of his life, navigating through this terrible bureaucracy of control.
Vous venez de le dire, hein, le fils d'Abed meurt parce qu'en fait, il doit se rendre dans une base de loisirs lors d'une sortie scolaire avec son école, mais il est obligé de prendre une route complètement détournée pour ne pas passer par une colonie israélienne. Est-ce que, selon vous, le système colonial israélien est responsable de la mort du fils d'Abed?
So the real theme of this book is a system of domination. And one of the things that the book illustrates is how deeply this system of domination reaches into the most intimate aspects of every Palestinian life. So much so that at one point, Abed even chooses a marriage partner based on the color of her ID, just so he can keep his job. He and his coworkers are at risk of losing their jobs in Jerusalem unless they find a way to get the right color ID, and the only way for them to do that is through marriage. The aim of the book is to really put yourself into the shoes of these characters and to understand this broader architecture of control and how it confines every move that a Palestinian makes. So this book is about an accident, and it was accidental in the sense that the driver of this semi-trailer who struck the bus didn't intend to hit the bus. He was driving too fast. It was a rainy day. He was negligent in many ways. But everything that unfolded from the moment that that bus was hit onward was entirely predictable. It was the foreseeable outcome of a policy of deliberate neglect of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians living on the other side of this wall. And every aspect of it is designed by Israel in order to expand Israeli Jewish communities and confine Palestinians into tighter and tighter spaces. The very route of this wall around this community, it was designed to keep as many Palestinians outside of Jerusalem, of the heart of Jerusalem, as possible, while relinquishing the minimum amount of land. And again, this is a long-standing Israeli policy, which is acquire maximum land with minimum Palestinians on it.
Vous parlez d'apartheid ou pas?
Absolutely. The word apartheid appears in the book as a quote, and it is a quote from the Israeli deputy defense minister who describes this segregated road system as apartheid roads. The idea of the book is to reach a very broad audience. And so apartheid as a word comes much later in the book. It's not the first word that appears in the book because I don't want to exclude the reader who is unwilling to think about this as a situation of apartheid. Once you finish the book, you cannot but conclude that this is a situation of apartheid, and you understand why all the leading human rights organizations in the world have now described Israeli practices as apartheid. We're talking about Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, the UN Human Rights Council, leading Palestinian human rights organizations, leading Israeli human rights organizations, and even people like the deputy defense minister talking about the segregated road system, and the former highest legal authority in Israel, the attorney general of Israel, has said that Israel is practicing apartheid.
Alors, vous prenez aussi le temps de parler d'amour impossible, de la dépression qui en suit, de fierté mal placée. Pourquoi c'était important pour vous d'aborder cet aspect-là?
I think it's important on a number of different levels. One is, this is really a book that is meant to be a work of narrative nonfiction, to be a nonfiction novel. And one of the greatest tragedies in Abed's life was the loss of his first love. And it actually was indeed organically connected to the accident because on the worst day of Abed's life, when he doesn't know the fate of his son and he thinks his son might have been killed, the first thought that goes through his head is, am I being punished for what I did to my ex-wife? And I needed to explain that and to put you in Abed's shoes. And again, we're trying to understand the whole story of Israel-Palestine. And we're doing that through Abed's life story. And so I wanted to tell, to put you in Abed's shoes, you had to understand what it was the biggest tragedy in his life before this day. And also to see how this system of control even affects his love life, who he chooses to try to marry.
C'était aussi important peut-être aussi de les humaniser.
Absolutely. Every person in this book needs to be a real three-dimensional character that you are invested in. And you are invested in the life of Abed by knowing about his deepest yearnings, his loves. And I felt it was essential to telling the story and to really understanding who Abed is and what his life story is.
Il y a aussi cette phrase d'Abed que moi j'ai notée dans le livre. À un moment, il dit « Tout Palestinien est un prisonnier ». Est-ce que, en écrivant ce livre aussi, c'est quelque chose que vous avez voulu montrer au monde? Cette phrase d'Abed qui résonne.
It is one of the most important things that I wanted the world to know. I wanted the world to understand what it really means. What it means in your bones, in your guts, to walk through, to live under this system of domination. There are so many reports written about Israel-Palestine, so many essays, historical analyses, NGO reports, and they're all important and they're all valuable. But nothing is as important as going there, seeing it with your own eyes, and having this feeling in your gut that this is a moral catastrophe. This is a system of deep, deep injustice. It is plain as day for anyone who goes and visits the area. And, you know, I'm a writer, so the best thing I can do is to bring you there through my writing and to give you that feeling in your guts about how wrong this system of domination is, this system of imprisonment.
C'était difficile à écrire.
If you're asking about whether it was difficult emotionally to write it, then the answer is yes. In a way, it was a confrontation with my worst nightmares. I have three daughters. My youngest was roughly the age of the children on this bus. I would do a day of reporting and come back and tell my wife the stories that I had heard. Sometimes I would be crying as I told it. She would be crying as she was listening. It was very difficult emotionally. Of course, this is nothing compared to the difficulty for the actual families involved. But in terms of the writing and the access that I was given and the trust that was bestowed on me, that part was very easy.
Alors, pour écrire ce livre, vous avez passé trois ans avec Abed et sa famille. Quelle relation vous avez aujourd'hui avec lui? Et vous dites dans les remerciements du livre, avoir le sentiment de faire partie de la famille. Est-ce que vous faites partie de la famille d'Abed?
Yes, it is true. Abed has become a close friend. I talk to him all the time. I visit him. It's much more difficult for him to visit me. There's a whole permit system that he has to go through, and he just recently tried to apply for a permit just to come to an event in Jerusalem at the American Colony Hotel 1 week ago, where I was presenting about this book, about his life. I wanted us to do it together. And he wanted us to do it together, but he couldn't get a permit to go 2 kilometers on the other side of this wall to present in the city that he grew up in to tell his own story. But he deserves all the credit for this book because he trusted me and he allowed this story to be told, a very intimate story. And he brought me into his family and embraced me in a way that was extraordinary.
Comment vous êtes parvenu à faire en sorte qu'il vous fasse confiance?
We initially were on book tour together when the book was published in the US and the UK on October 3rd. And we had planned for 6 weeks to be on tour in the US and the UK. And much of that tour was disrupted by October 7th, and the situation for Abed's family became quite precarious after October 7th in the West Bank, so he had to cut the tour short and go home. Many of our events were canceled also. But prior to that, this was a question that Abed was asked at almost every event that we did, was, why did you trust this guy? And the answer that he gave is, when he came into my home and I first told him the story, I saw tears in his eyes. Now, I think that I don't deserve really much of the credit. It all goes to Abed for this in trusting me. I also think a part of it was he and some of the other parents lived in a kind of cloud of silence around this tragedy. People don't want to upset a parent, so they dance around the subject. They don't bring it up. They want to do everything to avoid discussing it in front of the bereaved. But Abed told me he's yearning to talk about it. He loved to talk about it with me. And many times I would meet with him and he would cry as we talked. And I would apologize to him and I would say, I'm sorry for putting you through this. And he would say, don't apologize. I like this. I like crying. I like remembering my son. And the act of talking about him is like bringing him back and bringing him here with us. I feel his presence here by talking about him. And he often would introduce me, Abed, to his neighbors or to people in his town and say, this is Nathan, he's the man who makes me cry. But I think that he wanted to talk about it, and other parents did too.
Votre livre a été publié le 3 octobre, peu de temps avant les événements qui se sont produits le 7 octobre et l'attaque du Hamas, et puis maintenant la guerre actuellement à Gaza et la destruction de Gaza et le génocide en cours. Quel écho votre livre a actuellement avec ce qui se passe à Gaza? Je vous dis ça parce que dans votre épilogue, vous reprenez un reportage de la télévision israélienne qui montre notamment des Israéliens qui célèbrent et se moque de la mort de Milad, hein, donc le fils de Abed et des autres enfants qui sont morts dans cet accident tragique. Pour moi, qui ai beaucoup travaillé sur ce qui se passe actuellement à Gaza, ça a tout de suite fait écho. La déshumanisation des Palestiniens, c'est à ça que ça a fait écho. Qu'en pensez-vous?
I wrote this book before October 7th, but I understood at the time that I was writing that the dehumanization of Palestinians is absolutely essential to what we see taking place throughout the history of Israel-Palestine, but especially now we see since October 7th. It's that dehumanization that allows the level of brutality that we see, the levels of destruction that we see, and we see how it is normalized. You know, the people who were celebrating the deaths of these kindergartners they do not represent the majority of Israelis. There are many Israelis who would be horrified at the idea of celebrating the deaths of innocent kindergartners. And yet, it is an important facet of the society, and it is one that has only grown in strength since the accident. And we see that this kind of dehumanizing rhetoric, which is at the heart allowing the entire population to support the collective punishment of 2 million innocent people in Gaza, that allows, you know, the centrist or center-left president of the country to talk about there not being any innocence in Gaza, that allows for the starvation, the cutting off of food, fuel, electricity, and water to more than 2 million people who have absolutely nothing to do with the attack on October 7th. All of that comes from dehumanization. And where dehumanization comes from is, of course, that if you have a policy of controlling another people and subjecting them, dominating over them, then you have to invent rationales for treating people in this way, to treat them in a way that you yourself would never accept. And dehumanization comes from that. You also asked me about the connection between the story of this book and what we've seen since October 7th. And they're very connected in a number of different ways. One way is actually in the genesis of my writing this book. For over 10 years, I was writing about Israel-Palestine, and I was so frustrated by the fact that the world would only pay attention to Israel-Palestine when there was a war in Gaza, when there was heightened bloodshed, and all the world would call for restoring calm. We must restore calm. And over again, we would see violence erupt. The media pays attention to Israel-Palestine. World leaders say we must restore calm. And then everybody ignores it because they're tacitly or overtly accepting the situation in between those wars. That situation is not calm in any way. That situation is violent. It requires a tremendous amount of violence in order to control millions of people and deprive them of their basic civil rights. So the aim of my book was to focus our attention on this so-called calm that is anything but calm. And unless we address that system of domination, unless we address that apartheid, we are going to continually see more and more bloodshed. So in that very basic sense, this book is about a system of domination that existed before October 7th, that exists today, and will exist after this war is over. And we need to focus on that system and not just on the bloodshed if we want to see some kind of a better future in this place. Another way in which the book is very connected to Gaza is that the overall policy of Israel in terms of establishing settlements is to take the areas that are less populated and take those over, and it's much easier to expel Palestinians, to take over their land when there are just a few of them. When there is a very densely populated Palestinian area, for the most part, Israel doesn't try and settle them. There's a few exceptions, East Jerusalem and Hebron, but mainly, if you have a densely populated Palestinian area like Gaza, like the town of Annata and the Shuafat refugee camp, the idea of Israel is to wall off that area, to fence off that area, to enclose that area, to constrict Palestinians into those limited spaces while expanding the Jewish settlements around them. And Gaza is an area that was fenced off, that was separated from the rest of Palestine. This is something that long precedes Hamas's control of Gaza. The permit system was first applied to Gaza in the early 1990s, making it more difficult for Gazans to access the rest of Palestine. And then a fence went up around Gaza again early in the Oslo process. So the community where these people live of Annata and Shuafat camp is also, like Gaza, a densely populated area. Israel doesn't really have a hope of settling it with Jews. And so what they did instead is to wall it off, just like they have done with Gaza.
Merci Nathan d'être venu sur le plateau de Blast. Et je rappelle donc votre livre, Une journée dans la vie d'Abed Salama, qui est publié en France aux éditions Gallimard.
Thank you for having me. It was really a pleasure to be with you.
les podcasts
de Blast.